Bam Electric Ghost, and we're with Brett Ridgway for the first time. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great, Keith. How about yourself, sir?
I'm having a good beginning of the new year. Things are going okay. Off the new year. I have to mention our sponsor, which is Newsly. Newsly is an iOS app that actually takes video podcasts and translates them to audio. And we are really within an hour, we'll be on that platform so people can check us out. Use coupon code GHOST, get 1 month free premium subscription and start listening. So check that out. And so Brett, this is the first time we've had you on the show. And I was reading about you. You're a 25-year veteran of the speaking industry. Is that always what your primary job is? You're a public speaker?
Well, my primary focus these days, Keith, is honestly helping aspiring speakers learn how to build a profitable speaking business the right way. I got my start in the industry about 25 years ago when I was asked to manage the backroom sales table at an internet marketing conference. I honestly didn't even know what backroom sales meant back then, but I hadn't been to Las Vegas before, so it sounded good to me. So I went out and managed the back sales table for a guy who was putting on a conference. And that led to a side business where over the course of the next 15 years, I probably managed about 150 different events. And so I got to see from a behind the scenes perspective, kind of what speakers do well, what they don't do so well. I probably saw 2,000 different speakers in person in that time. And then they actually cornered me at an event in the early 2000s when they found out I was doing some product fulfillment for a website I had put up back in 1995, aimed at a particular niche. And they found out I was doing product fulfillment for my own stuff. And so they cornered me and said, hey, will you do some fulfillment for me? And so I actually founded a company called Speaker Fulfillment Services back in 2003. And that's a company that provides product duplication and fulfillment services for speakers, authors, and information marketers. So I've been behind the scenes for a number of years between the fulfillment and between managing the back of the room. And then eventually I did get the gumption myself to step out from the back of the room and get up on stage myself and share some of what I've learned along the way.
So you're also the author of 7 books that focus on this type of stuff, right? All your books focus on this area?
Yeah, all the books are in what I would call the, quote, expert space. So the first book I wrote was actually aimed at event promoters. And it was about how to increase their backroom sales. And then I wrote a book about mistakes that information marketers make because I was in the fulfillment world and I saw products coming through the door all the time. And then I did a book with a colleague of mine about website mistakes that online business owners make. And then I did one about mistakes authors make. You catch a theme here, mistakes. And then I did one called ABCs of Speaking with a couple of ladies. So everything's been in the what I would call the author, speaker, event promoter, information marketer niche, essentially.
Well, I think that kind of translates to a lot of things because a lot of people, don't think about it. But musicians, we are our own business. We have to market a product that happens to be like a CD or a download or a concert. So people say, well, why are you talking to different people? Well, because if you talk to business people or people who are trainers or people who have come up with, ways to be better, anybody can benefit from that. You know, because a lot of us, we're in a business, This podcasting is a business and how you grow and how you present yourself. We can all learn from the tips and of the trade that you've probably come up with. So I guess you talk about how you started in the industry and then you have an upcoming book about how to build a profitable speaking business. Do you want to talk about that first talk about how that worked, how that came about?
I'm really excited about that book. It is based on the 25 years behind the scenes primarily and actually working with a publisher, met with them on Monday and the book will be available mid-March, but it's about the war stories from behind the scenes about things that I see people do that are just, you make you shake your head and wonder, as a speaker, why they would do such a thing. I mean, here's a story for you, Keith. I was managing the back room at an event a few years ago. And the speaker had the ideal situation in terms of when you're a platform seller, they had the table rush, people flocking to the back table to buy what they offered there. Unfortunately, I saw every penny within a month of the event have to be refunded to the tune of $375,000, all because of a mistake that speaker made. Another time we were doing a product launch for a guy in the Forex market, foreign exchange currency. And midway through the first day, they suddenly had their merchant account shut off. And it probably cost them, I estimate, somewhere between $300,000 and $400,000 worth of sales. And it's something a simple phone call would have prevented. But they didn't pick up the phone and call their merchant account provider and say, hey, I'm doing a product launch. We're going to be running a lot more money through our account than we normally do. I mean, so when you have a massive spike of volume, the merchant account provider goes, whoa, red flag. There must be fraud going on here or something.
Oh, so they shut it down because they thought it was fraud.
Yeah. And it killed their launch. I mean, it cost them hundreds of thousands of dollars. So, I mean, those are just a couple examples of stupid mistakes I've seen speakers make that hurt them in the pocketbook very badly.
That seems like it's a recurring theme about trying to, like, you know, recover from errors or prevent errors. And I think that's something that people do have to think about in terms of their preparation when they go to do something, you know, because I traveled to Japan one time and I forgot to tell my bank I was going to Japan.
Oh, yeah.
So what happened when I went to the ATM, they wouldn't let me get any money. And it took like days and days to get that approved. And I'm sitting in Japan and I can't access my money. Now, luckily, before I went, I had transferred like a bunch of money into yen, and I had, you know, a bunch of yen with me. So I survived until I got it fixed. But that's like, you know, the kind of precursor, like if you're going to go to a foreign country, you better make sure you have access to your capital.
Yeah, I had a similar situation. My wife and I went to Israel a couple months ago, and you know, trying to do banking over there is just a royal pain in the butt, frankly. So, you know, lesson learned.
Yeah, Japan wasn't that fun either. So when you, I guess not just getting on the stages, because now a lot of public speaking, people do like web shows like this. They do podcasts, they do, you know, conference calls with tons of people and the big presentations. So I see that you work with a lot of corporate clients. Do you have different strategies versus that something is a web conference or a web call, or it's an actual, you know, presentation, like a physical presentation that happens to be on the net, or one that's physical? And maybe there are different techniques for when you're on the net versus physically at a venue.
You know, there are certain things that are different, but there are so many commonalities that, you know, it's kind of hard to differentiate. I mean, I view the speaking industry this way, Keith. I mean, I think in my mind, there are three types of speakers. One is the keynote speaker who is paid a fee to come and deliver a presentation to a corporation or an association. The second is what I would call the platform seller. That's a person who speaks typically at a multi-speaker event and then offers some type of product or service at the back of the room. And that's the world that I primarily came up through. Mm-hmm. Then the third is the regular business owner. It could be a chiropractor, a plumber, an electrician, or pipe, whatever, who uses speaking as a marketing tool to build their brand and build awareness, but they're not necessarily directly selling from the stage. And certainly the speaking industry is one that's changed considerably over the last few years due to COVID. I mean, in-person events are starting to come back, but virtual summits and podcasts are a lot more popular, obviously, than they were even a couple years ago. And obviously it's a world that you play in, and I'm getting ready to play in with my own podcast. And I mean, the biggest difference, you know, I think the biggest difference obviously is for the event host more so than the speaker. I mean, the speaker needs to deliver solid content, and if they're selling, seamlessly transition between their content and their close. But for the event promoter, it's about, you know, getting your audience engaged, and you got to use different tricks and tools to get people involved in a virtual event than compared to an in-person event. So yeah, there's some things that are different, but as I said, there's a lot more in common. It's just a matter of, you know, knowing your content as a speaker, knowing how you're going to handle that interaction and build the rapport with the audience as both an event promoter and a speaker to make it work in the best scenario for all of you.
So a lot of times the people you work with, they've got like a back table and they got their product, so people can go in that venue and actually go touch the product or buy the product.
Yeah, typically in the multi-speaker event world, you'd have an event, they would run 3 to 4 days, typically feature what we would call hard topics, which are how to make money type things, essentially, or soft topics or things like relationships, etc. But, you know, they would get up, if they have a 90-minute presentation, typically about 80% of that time is going to be spent delivering content. And then the last 15 to 20% is going to be their pitch, essentially, on whatever they're offering at the back of the room. And so, you know, I've seen speakers offer anything from one-on-one coaching to masterminds to group coaching to master classes. I mean, you name it. Anything could be offered from the stage. Now, typically, the event promoter is going to want you to have a higher ticket item. I mean, the speaking industry is one where we definitely saw a shift over time in the pricing of products offered from the stage. But at most of these events, you know, the promoter is looking for, you know, a product $1,000 to $2,000 is going to be sold, because the usual way that it's done, Keith, is a 50-50 split between the event promoter and the speaker.
They get a percentage.
Yep, yeah. they take half of whatever you offer from the stage in terms of the price. So, you know, they don't want you coming in and pitching your $15 book from the stage, because there's no money in it for them in that scenario. Yeah. So,
yeah. So you're actually pitching a service, like, so you're a life coach and you got to pitch like a service that's going to cost a subscription price that maybe could go into the thousands if you're going to go to a facility and take part in a physical life coaching event. I've actually talked to a life coach in Hawaii where they actually have people come to his retreat and they physically stay there. And it's like, it does cost, you know, a pretty penny. It's not like a $15 thing. So you would think, you could probably work out a sales thing. That's interesting that it's 50%, because like musicians, we can't live off our merch. And we don't get that kind of split. Like if we sell t-shirts or sweatshirts like this, we get most of it. But the venues don't really get a lot of our merch. That's kind of the way it's worked with us. So it's interesting to hear that you guys have like a 50 split, which is like,
that's the way it typically works in the speaking world. You know, the music world, I have a couple of colleagues who are working with some artists in Nashville right now, helping them create their digital platforms and all that, because as they tell me, and maybe you can react to this yourself, Keith, the music industry has been in many ways fairly slow to adapt the new realities of streaming music and all that stuff. And
you got
people like Don Henley who are trying to keep things the way they were, and the industry's changed so much that it's blowing right by them.
Yeah. I mean, the way the Eagles used to operate, you know, where they could jump on their plane and they could go control the concert, control, you know, the distribution of their material, and they owned the record label. I think they had a division of a record label that had their logo on it. That kind of changed. I mean, we do make more money by showing up at a venue and selling merch. And actually now licensing is how we make money. We make money because we'll license a song to a company, and that company will pay us far more than what Spotify or Apple or any Amazon ever pays us. And so also video games. If you license a song for a video game, your royalty rate is significantly higher than you get on Apple or Spotify. And so I've been working on stuff like that, because that's where you have to go. You have to go where the money goes. That's the nature of the beast, you have to change.
Yes, you do. I mean, the speaking industry is one that's changed a lot over time. The music industry's changed a lot. I mean, the fulfillment business. I founded the fulfillment company, and back in the day, it was all about the big box package, thump value. They talk about thump value of an info product. So you get, you know, 3 manuals and 10 CDs and 10 DVDs, and it was all about thump. Well, you know, people move primarily to digital delivery of their products. And so the typical information product has gone on a massive diet, Keith, compared to what they used to be. Now, that being said, I think it's a mistake, honestly, for an information marketer to dive into the digital only pond fully, because you still have some people that want tangible goods. And if you don't even offer that to people, then I think you're missing out on an opportunity. I mean, my wife and I watch movies on Netflix all the time. But I mean, we went down to the used video store and bought, you know, a dozen DVDs the other day for $20. Well, you can't rent them for Redbox for $20. I mean, so
there's still a reason, like, people will, in our industry, they'll buy vinyl, Right. Yeah. So we have modern bands that are actually putting out vinyl, and you make a lot more money on your vinyl. Like you can charge like $30 on a vinyl record. You'll get 0.005 of a penny
for a
stream, right? For a stream. That's what you get. If you sell a vinyl, you could probably get $15 of that $30 after you deal with the cost of putting it together. You can make 15 bucks per vinyl. You can sell more, like 1,000 vinyls make more than you do on 300,000 streams. And so, or even cassettes or thumb drives, the making physical content, there's still with music, there's that connection that I think it also would apply to doing something like some people physically want that manual because they don't like looking at their iPad all day or they don't like looking at the computer. They want something they can actually page turn. And so, it's like when your kids are still buying textbooks, even though there's a bunch of them that are digital, they still go to college and you buy the physical textbook because there's something about it that's still useful.
People ask me all the time, you know, the fulfillment company, do you still ship books? And yes, we ship thousands of books. I mean, I'm one of these guys where I don't like to read books on Kindle. If I want a book, I want a book that I can hold and flip the pages and, you know, not... I just don't do electronic. If I get
especially if you're learning, you like putting the sticky notes and writing in it, right? You know, there's something about having a sticky note or writing it or highlighting a book. It makes always felt like I actually really learn it if I took the time to highlight and sticky note and write my little notes in the border. Then I actually digest the material that if I'm actually there on the iPad, not that I don't have it. There's certain things I'll use for the iPad. I'll read a short article about a music machine and I want to review. It's very short. It's like a couple pages. Okay, fine. But if I'm reading something substantial, I tend to want a book.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I mean, if I download a PDF online, I'm going to print it out to read it. I'm not going to read it online. Even if it's 20, 30 pages, I'm going to print it out to read because I want to be able to highlight it and look for the key things versus reading it on a screen. If it's just on a screen, pretty soon it's out of sight, out of mind, honestly. So,
yeah, I don't retain it. I'm old school. You know, when I went to a liberal school, it's like I had all my books. I still got all my books in the basement, so you know, I never got rid of them. But so one of the things, like what's the biggest oops moment that you've seen from a speaker? I think you talked about it, but maybe we can find another one.
Oh, I can find another one for sure. So, all right. So I was actually having lunch with a colleague a few years ago, and he had built up a pretty substantial list in the financial services sector. He had a list of about 55,000 people. And so he had an established brand, and he'd been communicating with them for a long time, delivering meaningful content and all that. And then for whatever reason, he decided he wanted to bring in an internet guru to help him craft a new email campaign. So they put together this hard-hitting, very salesy issue of his newsletter or email and sent it out to his list. And it started to happen right away, Keith. Unsubscribe, unsubscribe, unsubscribe. When all was said and done, a list of 55,000 people was now a list of 5,000 people.
Oh, wow.
And it was like, ouch. I mean, obviously a lot of those people weren't going to buy anything anyway, but I think it's a tremendous mistake to bring anybody in to work on your brand without fully educating them on how you communicate with your list in the past and maybe do some kind of transition over to a more salesy approach or whatever.
Just to
cold turkey switch the method of your communication, the tone of your communication. I mean, it killed this guy's list. I mean, it was crazy. I mean, we were talking a little bit ago about, you know, I think it's a mistake to do digital only in terms of products or whatever. Well-known guy had a newsletter that had tens of thousands of subscribers. And then, you know, the digital world came along and he said, well, I'm going to deliver it digitally because then it doesn't cost me anything. Well, massive unsubscribes, massive. I mean, again, it killed his list because people were used to receiving a physical newsletter. So you got to be very careful when you're messing with your brand and you're switching up how you do things.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing because one of the things in the music industry is people trying to figure out, you know, the young kids or all these like people in the underground are coming through like TikTok and Reels and, you know, Instagram Reels and YouTube Shorts, the short content video. The short content video has become like the new way to market as a musician, as an actor, as all kinds of influencers are using, Instagram and TikTok as a big platform to push things. And initially it was a lot of quirky humor, right? And now musicians are actually dropping songs, and people were thinking, well, I have to become a comedian. And I'm like, well, if you're not really a comedian, you're probably not going to be able to become one. because that was like the form that was really working. And you're like, well, maybe you can't do that because you're not good at it.
I mean, I'm not doing any of those things yet, Keith. TikTok, Reels, Shorts, etc. So I'm way behind the times, I guess. But I mean, I actually did my first Facebook Live today. So,
but there is like a thing where people thought, like, I'm an old school musician. I figured like the only way I'm gonna connect on TikTok is I have to create some irreverent, weird humor, right? But you don't. You can actually find a way to take your song, right, and shorten it. Mm-hmm. So I'm a progressive rocker. My stuff's like 7-8 minutes long. So it's like, well, how's that going to work? I got to clip it down to fit like 15, 30 seconds, 90 seconds, and find the sweet spot that would work within that genre. And then I started to figure it out. And I suddenly went from like, a couple hundred to like 15,000 reels viewed on Facebook.
Cool.
So it's like, whoa, I figured it out. Cause I wasn't doing it right for like 2 years. And then my daughter is like 22, and she said, you're doing it wrong. So I actually like the good thing of having a 22-year-old around is like she showed me like, that's how you connect on that. So then it's like, well, sometimes you need to talk to somebody else, to figure out what to do.
Yeah. I mean, you haven't recorded a video, Keith, of you picking out your wardrobe for the day or something, like seems to be half the videos on TikTok now.
I have all kinds of things to trend. It's always like this stuff is something that's like out of Saturday Night Live. It's like this very short 30-second comedic bits that seem to connect millions. Some of these TikToks, they're like, wow. And you're looking at it like, well, how can I get that number? I was just happy I had 15,000 because I always had nothing. But I'm like, wow,
numbers
how do you
amazing.
Get like
numbers
seven?
Are amazing on some of those. Yeah. Jeez.
Yeah. So you're like, well, there's something there. I got to figure that out.
Yeah. You just got to figure out how to monetize it, though. I mean,
Because how do you take 7 million people that like your thing and actually turn it to somebody that's actually going to buy something?
Yeah.
Right. As soon as you try to throw something where they go to buy it, that 7 million probably drop. Because like these people are people that, well, I don't want to buy anything. I just want to watch you do something funny. So instead of you trying to monetize it to that audience, they're like, I'm not buying anything. So
can't you put a link down in the description below the videos or whatever that would drive them to a site?
Yeah, you can drive them, but whether or not they're actually going to click it. Yeah, most of that's the click-through rates are like, how do you get, because if they're really just in the comedy, like, well, what's that got to do with anything? But, if you were able to sell them a t-shirt or a sticker, something that they would want, you got to figure out, like, what would that type of audience want? And then figure out how to get it to them. That's the trick.
There's always something new to learn, man.
Oh, yeah. I mean, as a musician, I've been kind of adamant about not sampling, because I think sampling kind of takes other people's work. And I kind of like to write original work, but that's where millions and millions of streams are coming from, people who sample stuff that's already been done. Mm-hmm. And then you're like, wow, that seems like cheating. But I guess that's what works for certain people. But I kind of stick to my guns. Is like, I still like to write original stuff, so that's fine. I'm going to stay in that. But then you can figure out how to coordinate it so that you could build something that seems like what this sampling stuff is, which is all clip-based stuff. So we base stuff that's very groove-based and clip-based. So he's okay, that's the aesthetic. I don't necessarily have to do what they're doing, but I can get into understanding what their aesthetic is and why do people like it. And then you can try to create something that's not taking other people's content, but in the same ballpark. So you have to like look at what's going on and figure it out.
Well, I'm going to have to search your music stuff out, Keith, so.
Yeah, well, music is just a big part of what I do. But What do you think the biggest thing about getting more gigs as a speaker? Because like artists and musicians, we're always trying to get gigs, but as a speaker, so if we can kind of understand the idea of getting a gig, that's a big motivator for any artist. So speakers are in the same kind of zone. So how do you do that?
Yeah, I think it's equally true of musicians and speakers and all that. And I think the biggest asset any business person has, whether it's a musician or speaker or whatever, is their relationship capital, the people that know them and the people that they know in the industry. I've been spending a lot of time lately doing various networking events to be seen out there. And it's so important to be seen. I mean, if you're going to be on a virtual summit, for example, I mean, you need to participate in them as a speaker, even if you're not actually presenting at that particular event. People need to see you. You need to reach out. You need to be comfortable getting into these networking events. And there are so many virtual ones online now that it's something that people can take advantage of and should take advantage of. So, I mean, I think relationships are by far your biggest asset as a business person. And you need to make sure that you nurture those relationships. And it needs to be about, you know, what can I do for them standpoint versus what can they do for me first and foremost? Because if they view it that you're only in it for yourself all along and you're not willing to help them out in any way, then they're going to see through you pretty quickly and you won't get the results that you want. So you got to come in with a giving, sharing attitude, and, you know, it'll develop over time. I mean, one of the books I wrote was called Mistakes Authors Make. And, you know, we went out on a limb and decided we were going to try to drive that one to a number one Amazon bestseller at a live event. So we're either going to fall flat on our face with egg or we were going to succeed. And so I was speaking at that event. And so we launched the book at that particular event. It was an author event. And between the people in the crowd and the people that I have known for years ahead of time that I had never asked anything of that were more than willing to help me announce that book launch, we were able to push it to number one. But it was all about relationships. The fulfillment company that I founded in 2003, Keith, I mean, it came about because of all the speakers I had gotten to know in the industry from handling the back of the room. And so I knew 20 years ago a lot of the biggest names in the speaking industry, and many of them became clients. But it was all about relationships. It was all about people that you know and people that know you and like and trust you. So figure out how you can nurture relationships and come in with a giving attitude, and you'll have a far greater chance for success.
Yeah, that's kind of like the way the music industry is kind of like a barter thing nowadays. A lot of artists, like, we will go and guest on another artist's album, and we might not get paid right away. Right? We might just do it because we want to get out there.
Yeah.
Right. So a lot of us will show up on somebody else's tour. We'll show up on their record. Well, you know, if you have a podcast, you'll go on their podcast. They'll go on your podcast. You kind of go into like this communal idea that, like, oh, we're like the Grateful Dead. We're like a big bunch of group of people. We're going to have this collective, kind of like a Deadhead or like, it was like, you know, the Allman Brothers or something. It's like you get these fans, and then the fans become part of the show, or they become part of the engagement. You say, hey, some of these guys know how to play. Yeah. So let's push this guy. Let's talk to this person. So a lot of it is like, you know, the podcast over the years, I've actually been able to create albums from the podcast, have guests actually come on my album. I go on their album.
Cool.
Where I get to work as a session musician on their record, or I do some production on their record. And the whole idea was, you know, it wasn't necessarily that way. I wanted to do that, but we end up kind of vibing, and, you know, you get a vibe with people, you know, doing this Podmatch had another podcaster. I'm going to be on their podcast this month because they liked seeing me here. So then I said, oh, I'll go on yours. So it's kind of like, you know, you give and you get.
I've been doing a lot of podcast swaps myself, so I know where you're coming from. So.
Yeah, I think it's a good way to get out there because, like, you know, in terms of podcasting, people, like musicians for a long time, was like, oh, we're only going to put one album out a year. In the modern world, because of TikToks and Reels and stuff, you can put out 4 or 5 clips of songs a day, right? So you can put out tons of content. And one artist this year actually put out 145 songs, a hip-hop artist. And people would have told you in the past, you shouldn't do that much content. But that's not the way the world works anymore. Mm-hmm. The way the world works is if you put out the content, you get more attention. You get your fans actually want to, because they're kind of in this consumer thing where they don't want to wait for Axl Rose to take 5 years to do a record. You know, that's not the way the world is anymore.
So do you tour yourself ever, Keith?
I used to play before COVID in Boston and New York, do shows, and I just did some virtual concerts for a platform that went away. But for the whole month of December, I spent like 15 days playing live sets, 15-minute sets on these for 15 days on Sessions Live, which was a really cool platform, but they went out. But I kind of went, they went out with a bang. I was playing with them for the last legs of their existence. But yeah, there's a lot of cool stuff like that, like where you can, they had these virtual platforms where musicians can go on, play a 15-minute set on a virtual stage. You know, one of them was like a Winterland Berlin, and then Winterland like Las Vegas. And they would basically be capturing artists from different areas of the world, and then having guests, people come on. And it's just really, you know, the virtual stages allow musicians to you know, just, oh, I can't play anymore. I was playing for, 15 days straight. So you can play. It's just you have to set yourself up to be able to play. You know, some people don't have the setup to be able to play from their home base. Yeah, they have to go somewhere because they don't have their equipment. I, 4 years ago, I invested in the equipment because I got sick of taking my U-Haul and my roadies to Boston and New York, and I got tired of it. I said, well, I don't want to do that anymore. I just got tired of doing it. I like doing it. I like playing. And then COVID made it worse to get better. I love playing New York. I'll play New York again. But I guess I don't want to play it every week. It's too much work. Coming from New Hampshire, at least. But if I lived closer, it probably wouldn't be a problem. But
well, it's just a short hop down to Boston, though, right?
Yeah, Boston's more doable. Fenway's cool. There's a bunch of clubs around Fenway. But yeah, it's just, I think just being on the scene, you just got to put yourself out there. Like, you're saying, like, in the podcast strategy or a strategy as a speaker, that you need to show up every way you can that you physically can, handle. Because I guess you don't want to burn yourself out.
Yeah, you got to pick and choose your battles for sure. I mean, I've had a challenge over the last month or so, overbooking in terms of trying to get on more networking events than my schedule would actually permit. Because you're trying to record podcast episodes of your own as well as guesting on podcasts. And you just can't do it all. You truly have to pick and choose your battles.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a strategy to figure out what's going to work, what you can let go? Like, do you, or do you just kind of like, oh, just figure out what I can let go? Or do you try to think about like, what's the biggest bang for the buck?
Well, that from the standpoint of, I try to get into each one at least once to see how their flow is and what kind of audience to get on there. Because obviously networking is about meeting as many people as you can reasonably. And so, if it's a networking event of 100 people versus a networking event of 10 people, I'm going to pick the 100 people one. And, there are actually some of these networking events that are charging to attend, which is fine. I usually check them out at least once and see if I want to spend, $20 or whatever to go back and be at that networking event again. I mean, I've even run across some podcasts, Keith, that are, that they now charge you to be on their podcast. You can move to the front of the line, so to speak, by paying a fee or whatever. And I've done that once or twice, but as a general rule, there are enough podcasts out there that you really shouldn't have to pay to find one to be on. I mean, if it's a really, really great one that has a massive reach, then spend that $50 or $70 or whatever it is to do it. But, there's no shortage of opportunities out there. Use services like Podmatch or whatever to, find suitable shows to be on and suitable guests for your show. So.
Yeah, I mean, when I first started, I was on an app called Spearman, which was just one of these iOS apps, like Wisdom, And I don't know if you ever heard that one, but they just let you go on the phone and do audio. It's no video, it's just audio. So for when I first started in 2016, I was on SoundCloud and this New York DJ named Rocktunes actually found me and sent me a note saying, hey, I want to do a podcast interview with you. I've seen your SoundCloud. You got all these songs on SoundCloud. I want to talk to you. I said, what's that? I didn't even know what a podcast was. It was 2016. So what's that? Mm-hmm. And it was like a radio thing. I said, oh, okay. It's like a radio interview. So then I went on. And then we vibed so good, we started doing a show. We actually did a show for like 3 months. We talked about music for 3 months on his experiment. And then I decided, hey, why don't I go and do this and interview all these artists that I know on Instagram? And I started pitching to them, hey, I'll do an interview like I did with Rocktunes. Here's what it sounded like. Send them the link. And then I started getting interviews. I started doing like 4 or 5 interviews with bands in Australia and the UK, all over the place. And I was just so surprised. The biggest thing was I would ask an artist if they wanted to do it, and they would do it. And I was like, I was so shocked. I wasn't going through an agent. I was talking to them directly through their DM on Instagram.
Yeah.
And so what, I was getting to
what are some of the big names you've been able to get on your podcast then, Keith?
I was able to get a Grammy Award winning producer named Billy Hume, who produced Lil Jon and the lead singer of the Goo Goo Dolls. He won a Grammy. And he has a brand new band called Tokyo Teens he's pushing out. And I also interviewed a Grammy Award winning producer named Kevin Stratton. And Kevin Stratton actually worked with Stevie Nicks. He worked with Eddie Van Halen on Jump. He was behind the DX7 synthesizer, worked with the band Toto on the song Roseanne. Mm-hmm. So he's a big Grammy Award-winning producer. He worked with Quincy Jones, worked with Janet Jackson, worked with all these people. And he liked my stuff. And I was like, wow, this guy is big. I knew who he was. Yeah. And the fact that he came on my show and he said he liked what I was doing with my Moogs and stuff, I was like, that was like one of the biggest compliments ever. As a young, you know, as a producer that's kind of underground producer, to get a big guy like that, like a Grammy Award-winning producer, that say that they like your stuff, that kind of gave me, and they gave me some cred with the other musicians. I started being able to interview this band that just came over from France called Rosaway, and they're starting to hit big. And it's a flautist and a drummer, a husband and wife, and they are like nominated for a Grammy. And I got them when they were still kind of, people didn't know who they were. I knew they were good, but like, that's my whole thing, is to try to get bands that are merging.
Yeah.
Like right when they're coming up and then they kind of break through. So yeah, that was a pretty cool band to get.
Cool. Never heard of.
Yeah, like 350. Yeah. You probably never heard of them, but the Grammy Award winners are kind of like, you know, those are the big people I dealt with. And then most of them are like, my whole thing is I deal with emerging and independent artists that aren't super big, but they're kind of, some of them are highly regarded, like they'll win Grammys and stuff, or they'll be nominated for Grammys. So that's kind of zone I'm in. Cause I'm trying to push who I think should be listened to. That's like my whole point, but.
Well, my music is the 70s and 80s. You get much past that, I can't tell you much about music at all.
Yeah, well, I'm a big fan. Like I mentioned, like Pete Townsend. Like I love The Who. I love Led Zeppelin. I love all that 70s stuff. Hendrix, all that. You know, I'm a classic rock, Genesis guy. But I do know a bunch of new stuff just because I'm kind of in on that. But it's just what you do today is you try to, you know, that's where I got beyond that. Well, now I'm talking to people like yourself and CEOs and influencers and podcasters, because you have to kind of change to adapt. You know, when I first had a podcast, I was, you know, getting certain numbers, and then that those type of interviews weren't getting as many, you know, the numbers that I'm getting now from other types of interviews. So I said, okay, I'm going to expand into other things. And you have to kind of adapt and change as it goes. You find new venues, you find new places to go. That's the only thing as a podcaster I would say. There's new platforms coming up all the time. So I tried like Wisdom Out. I'm on Anchor FM. I'm doing this thing. There's a new one that only does like 5 minutes. You know, there's the one that just came out, and all you can do is 5 minutes. And it's a kind of a test to see what you can do with that. And so there's all kinds of new tricks coming out, and it's like sometimes I just try each one, and it's like, well, I don't like it. So, but you should yeah. you just try them.
It amazes me the number of podcast outlets there are now. I mean, I was looking at somebody's site, and they had listed they were featured on like 25 different places you could go listen to their podcast. I had no idea there were that many outlets for podcasts. So.
Yeah, I mean, when I first started on Anchor, there was like 11. And I'm like, I can end up hitting like 15, you know, when I do a podcast, it goes across. Cause like, well, I take this and I throw it on Anchor. Anchor sends it to 11 places.
Yeah.
They send it to like 11 places automatically. And so that's how we are able to distribute. We get distributors like Anchor, which is part of Spotify, but they will take your podcast and send it like 11 other places. Like iTunes and YouTube, Amazon, Google Play, Radio Public. Now it's the audio version, not the video version. The video version will live like on Facebook and Twitch. And actually, Twitter can do video now if they stay around.
Wait, is it limited like 20 yeah. minutes on Twitter?
No, Twitter, I actually had a setup, but I had some problems with Twitter, so I'm not on Twitter anymore. But Twitter, when I was on it, they had a thing for podcasters that if you did a platform, your Twitter, your podcast would actually, if you went an hour, people could see an hour on Twitter. And I was very amazed by that, because if you try to upload that, right, if you try to do it yourself, it won't work. But when you go through a distributor like StreamYard had a relationship with them, and when you send that live, it actually gets a permanent link, and then you actually can see it. So there's a bunch of episodes of this podcast that were on Twitter that actually are like an hour long on Twitter, which is pretty cool.
I was trying to upload one today, and it was like 8-minute video, and it wouldn't upload. It's like,
no, you can't do it yourself. You have to do it.
The connections you have, man.
You have your distributor, you just got to set yourself on a distributor, and then, you know, like the Restreams and the StreamYards of the world and the Anchor FMs, they can distribute to other platforms, set you up. If you try to just do it yourself through your own website, you'll find that there's limited reach through your own website. It's cool to have your own website, and I have a website, but for my distribution of my podcast, I use established platforms that I have discovered since 2016 that actually can get to my people I need to get it to. Mm-hmm. So that's what I learned.
Well, I'm still learning, man. I'm still learning. So,
well, it's a process. You know, I think as you go, like, I never even knew I wanted to be a podcaster. It just kind of came because this guy from New York said, do I want to be on the podcast? And then we liked it so much that we started doing one. And then I just didn't stop. And I kept on going and finding out where I could go. And it's somewhat interesting. And people say, well, as a music producer, why would you take time from production to do this? And what it does is it brings people to my brand.
Sure.
I get people who listen to the Ghost because they, well, who's this Ghost? And then they find out that I have a podcast, and they find out I have music. And people will go and check out the music. And so I get people who come in that maybe would have never come in. And that's kind of better than any bot I ever seen.
Yeah.
There's lots of bots. You don't want a bot, you want a real person.
Well, as I said, I'll be checking out your music now, man. So.
Yeah. What do you think about like the whole social media thing? I don't know how hard you're into it, but there's a lot of people out there trying to sell bots to all kinds of people. You know, there's all of these people on Fiverr that say that they can push your podcast and they can do this and do that. I've been kind of reluctant to look at any of them, kind of like, I can't see your ROI.
Yeah, I haven't, I mean, honestly done anything in that arena. I mean, I'm more active on social media than I was even a year ago, but I mean, I do Facebook. I do LinkedIn primarily. That's where I have my most followers. I just set up an Instagram account for the first time about a month and a half ago. So I'm late to the party there, and do Twitter. But, you know, I haven't even messed with the TikTok and the Reels and all that stuff yet. So,
well, you'll see all the marketers will come to you and they will say, oh, I can give you like more followers. And there's a lot of like scammers out there. There's a lot of people just come unannounced saying they can do X. And most of them are coming from like where? The Czech Republic.
I mean,
it's like where's my pants?
Yeah, this is truly another area where you got to pick and choose your battles. I mean, particularly if you're a solopreneur. I mean, you can't be on every platform actively, you know, every day and all that stuff. Now, if you got a team working behind you that can keep you posted on more platforms, great. I mean, go for it. But if you're doing it by yourself largely, you know, pick two or three that you think the majority of your audience would be active on and focus your efforts there. And it's more about being consistent across two or three platforms than scatterbrained across 10 platforms. And you're lucky if you post something once a month. So,
yeah, it's the only thing that's cool about the tools, that once you get out there and you realize that there's a lot of these tools that will go and blast your thing out to multiple platforms. Mm-hmm. So the question is, when they do it, some of these platforms have certain algorithms that would just blast and it's not going to do it, right? Because the way the hashtags and the keywords, that if you don't get the right ones, you can blast it everywhere and it's not going to go anywhere. Mm-hmm. So that's the half of the stuff is you find out when you get on the thing is actually getting somebody that knows SEO is better than getting somebody that knows bots. If somebody's sending you bots from Russia, like, I don't think there are really any peg fans in Russia. so it's more as a better investment for peg to go to an SEO expert and figure out the hashtags.
You mean the Phantom Electric Ghost doesn't have a big following in Russia? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Well, like, if you go to some of one time I did go to Fiverr and they said they could give me followers. And when I checked, they're all coming out of like Moscow. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, I don't think there's really anybody in Moscow. I think these guys are all bots. I think they're all made up. And when I checked it, I'm an IT guy, like, they were all bots. And like, really? Yeah. And so it's like, you know, an SEO investment into somebody that actually does custom hashtags, or knows how to hit the algorithm on Instagram, or knows how to hit the algorithm on Twitch, that is a better investment to find somebody that actually can get you real organic growth from tweaking of your hashtag and the tweaking of how you present or what time you present. Though that's way better information. That's what I found over time, is like, there are people that actually do know stuff and you got to find the real ones versus the fake ones. But
yeah, I think that buying followers is not the way to go on any social media platform, because it's going to be junk. It's going to be junk followers, and you're not going to get anything out of it. So you're paying money to build a list where you have people who aren't going to respond to anything you do. So, like you said, do the SEO, build up your site. I mean, ideally, you know, I left the fulfillment company a few months ago, and so I left my list behind. And so I'm starting from scratch, building my own email list. And it's one of these things, like, you know, it crawls along. And then, you know, hopefully you start to see that, but it takes time, and it's a matter of building things over time by delivering quality content and giving people things that they want. But it doesn't happen overnight. I mean, most, you know, overnight successes are 10 years in the making or 5 years in the making or whatever. So be prepared to pay your dues.
Yeah, that's true. I think that works for everything. And like, a lot of people think like the overnight hit wonder is somebody that's probably been in their studio for years, and it's probably like they got hundreds of tracks and it happens to be this one track connects.
Yeah,
and that's the way it is. We have hundreds and hundreds of tracks, and the ones that hit, a lot of times we can't tell you why it hit, because we're like, the ones we like as the musician that wrote it, most of the time the fans pick the one that I wouldn't pick. And it's really the producers and the media guys and the guys that actually know what's going to work with. If you ask the artist, they're like, well, I picked this one. And there's tons of stories of famous artists saying, like, I never thought that was going to go. It's like, the A&R guys put that out. And I'm like, no, that's not going anywhere. And that's the one that goes. And you're like, how do I know? I just wrote it.
Yeah. You say maybe the fans have better taste than you sometimes.
Yeah, well, you just don't know what they're going to dig because you're too close to it. I think what happens when you do work is, like, sometimes you're so close to it that you can't see. And this is why it's always good, I think, in any industry to have a second set of ears or eyes on your stuff. So one question for you, do you have people you kind of float ideas around before you actually work them out? Do you kind of like we do as the artist, we'll have a group of people that we send something to before we actually publish it.
I have three or four online groups that I actually participate in. So when I, you know, am recording a new video and I'd like some feedback or whatever, I'll post it to all those groups for input. Or, when I was looking to name the podcast, I put together a bunch of possible names, threw it out before the groups to see what resonated. So, yeah, I definitely take advantage of the groups I'm involved with to help craft the ideas. And I actively participate in a mastermind program where we get together in person a couple times a year and brainstorm each other's businesses. So I highly recommend, honestly, that any business person, you know, find a mentor. Try to learn something by going through the School of Hard Knocks is a very painful process. And so, you know, you can shorten that learning curve and get to success more quickly by actually investing in somebody who's been down the road before and can help you avoid those stupid mistakes like we talked about earlier that I've seen some of the speakers make. So
I think we're pretty much near the close of our time. But if I guess you're going to sum up in like three words, what do you think are the greatest keys to success for any speaker or author or information person?
Well, let's see. Number one, I would say relationships that we talked about already. Number two, I would classify as delivering quality content. So you've always got to have fresh things out there so that people come back. And if you're a business person, so I'm going to say you need to have a book. I mean, book's a great marketing tool and it establishes you as an expert in your industry. So relationships, content, book would be the three things I touch on off the top of my head.
So you think a book is really important? Because a lot of speakers, they might not have a book. They maybe have a program. They've got like a service, but they don't have a book. Lately, I've talked to a lot of mentors. Mm-hmm. They are books. So maybe they've learned that they need a book.
I think a book is critical. Number one, because it establishes you as the go-to person in your niche. So even local business people, like I said, electricians, chiropractors, doctors, plumbers, whatever, should write a book about tips related to their industry. And so when people have a need for that type of service, they're who they're most likely to go to because they're recognized as the industry leader in their area because they wrote a book. It gives you credibility that you wouldn't have otherwise, frankly. So, yeah, I think a book is critical, but people need to recognize it for what it is, Keith. It's primarily a marketing tool. Most people aren't going to get rich off selling books. It's the lead product. It's to introduce them into your world. And the real money is made in the back end, higher ticket price, coaching programs, masterminds, master classes, whatever it may be. So yes, you need to have a book. You should have several books. I mean, I've written eight now, but it's a way to get people into your world so that you can then have the ability to offer them those other products and services that are where the real money lies.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I mean, the only books I have are like lyric books and poetry books, but I should, since I got into podcasting, I probably should do a kind of like a, how did I get into podcasting? Maybe I do how did Peg get into podcasting and succeed or something? Come up with a book like that and then do that.
How do you use podcasting for musicians? Sounds like a natural book that you should write. So,
yeah, I've been kind of playing with the idea of how you can, why I do it as a musician. And then trying to sell that, and I think I've got you're convincing me more that I should probably continue with that thought and actually expand it.
You should do
into a real project. Yeah, it's probably worth doing. I think that what I've seen from the people I've been talking to in the last year, it just seems like it's a workable idea. It's like it's not something kind of flash in the pan. It's something that makes sense. So I want everybody to always make sure you check out the website there, which is brettridgeway.com. That will be clickable when we fully publish, and we're on Spotify Video Podcast and Apple Podcast and Google Play and all the other places we'll be. We're going to send you a landing page when we fully publish tomorrow. We are live tonight. We'll be fully published everywhere tomorrow. And we create a landing page that will have like the Facebook, Twitch, YouTube, Spotify, Apple blog page. And so we create that for everybody that we do a podcast with, and we'll send that off to you that you can go and share. Super.
Yeah, I'll be happy to put it out there. So appreciate spending some time with you today, Keith.
Yeah, no problem. I think it's great to learn about other people doing things and what you do as a speaker, you know, as a podcaster, everything you were telling me. I think all podcasters who watch this can take like everything we've been saying tonight and think about it. And if you're thinking about writing a book, maybe you should write that book.
I'll be looking for your title on Amazon soon, man.
Thank you, Ben.